This is Michael Cowan, and welcome to Trial Lawyer Nation.
You are the leader in the courtroom, and you want the jury to be looking to you for the answers.
When you figure out your theory, never deviate.
You want the facts to be consistent, complete, and credible.
The defense has no problem running out the clock. Delay is the friend of the defense.
It's tough to grow a firm by trying to hold on and micromanage.
You've got to front load a simple structure for jurors to be able to hold on to.
What types of creative things can we do as lawyers, even though we don't have a trial setting?
Whatever you've got to do to make it real, you've got to do to make it real. But the person who needs convincing is you.
Welcome to the award-winning podcast, Trial Lawyer Nation. Your source to win bigger verdicts, get more cases, and manage your law firm. And now, here's your host, noteworthy author, sought-after speaker, and renowned trial lawyer, Michael Cowan.
We're going to start a new feature on this podcast. It's Ask Michael and Mallory Anything. If you have anything you'd like to ask either Mallory or me, we're going to start doing an episode every couple months where we're going to answer your questions. So just send them in to me at michael@cowanlaw.com, and Mallory and I will answer them. Anything from, you know, legal strategy, marketing management, anything else in life you want to talk about, we'll be glad to talk about it with you. Again, ask Michael and Mallory anything. Just send us an email. We'll be glad to answer your questions. Welcome to today's Trial Lawyer Nation. I have with me Nicholas Liekas, a lawyer who got a fantastic verdict recently. Along with Jessica Brilo, a trial consultant that you've been a past guest on the show and has also helped him with the strategy to get that verdict. Cool. How are y'all doing today?
Excellent. Thanks for inviting us on the show.
You're welcome.
Good to see you, Michael.
Good to see you too, Jessica. It's been hours since we spoke.
Yeah.
Jessica and I are working a couple cases together right now. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. We talk frequently, which is great.
So, Nick, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm an attorney here in New York. We practice primarily in New York. We also practice in New Jersey as well. I opened up a firm about 10 years ago, I should say, with my brothers. I started as a law clerk here because I wasn't admitted to practice law. I was in law school at the time. And since that time, my brothers and I have started, in a single room where we're all sharing an office. There's three desks, answering our own phones and, you know, putting stamps on our own envelopes to now where we have about 150 people, 40
oh, wow.
lawyers. And, we try to, really maximize, what we're able to bring to our clients through our trial practice in New York and New Jersey.
Well, then I've got a bunch of new questions to ask you I had not anticipated.
Okay.
So first of all, just tell me the story. Let's just say getting cases. How did you go from just having three brothers sharing a room to getting enough work coming in where you have 150 people working there?
That's the hard part. As you build a reputation, knock on wood, the cases, they tend to find their way through referrals from other attorneys, through past clients that we've been successful in obtaining, awards for. When we first started, we were taking everything like most firms. Like everybody says the same thing. You take what comes and you try to maximize and do the right thing by clients and provide the customer service and provide, the feedback to referral partners. And we did that. I actually tried my first case. I was only admitted for about 2 weeks. So
oh, wow.
I came out of the gate grabbing as whatever trials nobody wanted to take, $100,000 policy cases that no one's really, looking forward to trying. I marketed myself as, hey, I'll try them. No one else is doing it. I'll try them. Let me see what I can do for you. And, after getting some solid results, we were trusted to handle some bigger cases. And then we started to really focus on, catastrophic injury, construction accidents, industrial accidents, trucking accidents. And that's how we built our, I don't want to say brand, but that's how we built our brand.
It is a brand.
It is a brand, but the primary focus is not so much on building our brand as it's really more focused on what can we do for our clients and how do we serve the community.
Right. Did you do anything to let other lawyers know that you had the willingness and ability to try cases and handle cases?
Well, when I first started, I didn't know I had the ability. I was certainly willing. I was certainly willing to do it. I was preparing cases for another law firm throughout college. And when I was in law school, I was preparing primarily just trial preparation for another law firm. So I got the opportunity to sit in on trials, which was invaluable to me. I got the opportunity to, you know, do all the groundwork that goes into trying a case. And it really taught me the framework of a case. You know, I always tell this to new attorneys, watch a trial. You know, you don't really know what goes into a case until you're in front of a jury, in front of a judge, and you need to know why things are important as you're doing your discovery and you're litigating a case. Because I feel like a lot of people don't get that experience. So I always tell people, you know, try to get some, you know, go sit in a courtroom. You know, it's open to the public. And that's part of how I learned.
So other than watching trials, what else have you done to develop your skills as a trial lawyer?
I actually had this conversation with someone recently. They asked me, you know, what can I do to, you know, really, you know, he's not an admitted attorney, thinking about going to law school. And I said, do stand-up comedy, you know, put yourself on the spot. You know, I'm sure people have said this many times before, but I mean, things like that, you know, trying to get the fear of public speaking out, you know, which I think after some time, you get more and more comfortable doing it. I think that's something that, you know, I was able to get a lot of experience with public speaking early on in my career, even before I became an attorney. And I think that helped a lot. The quicker you can get to a point where you're speaking to a jury, like you're speaking to friends in your living room, I think the better you'll do.
Absolutely. Anything else you've done to develop those skills?
I mean, we have a lot of good, you know, CLEs that we take here in New York. I'm sure around the country it's very similar. But, you know, I've watched a lot of great trial attorneys. I've learned from them, whether it's in-person CLEs or just watching them at trial. I went to Brooklyn Law School. It's right across from the courthouse in Brooklyn. So I would be probably as equal amount of time in the law school as I was in the courthouse. You know, when I heard there's a big trial coming up or an attorney that I knew was, someone that I need to watch. And I would just go in there and it was that's really what I was doing. I also had the benefit of learning from some really excellent attorneys and some very good trial attorneys. You know, some might say, top 10, top 20 in New York, that I was prepping trials for years. And, that was really where I got a lot of, experience.
Believe it or not, I can't really say it was my first jury selection because I didn't ask any questions. I took notes. I was at a big law firm. But my first experience with jury selection was in Brooklyn.
Oh, good at you. All right.
Yeah, 1996, while I was an associate at a firm called Cadwallader, Wickersham & Taft in New York City. Okay. Another lifetime ago. Yeah.
That's where I tried my first.
Our newest lawyer at our firm, who just got sworn in this week, I realized she was born after that. It's really, I have a lawyer working for me that was born after my first trial. It's really weird. So tell me a little bit about the case. And Jessica, I'm not forgetting about you. I just want to get some
background. No worries at all.
Sure. So we had a young gentleman who was 24 at the time. He was living in the Bronx. He was an immigrant from Bangladesh, and he was a bicycle delivery driver. So he would deliver food, whether it was on a bicycle or a hand truck. And that's what he did basically his entire time here in the United States. He was on his way to work one morning and he was at a subway station in the Bronx. It's a very old subway station. It's an elevated subway station. The design is not something that you would imagine a new build would look like, but he was at this subway station and he encountered a defect in the platform. And as he's passing through the platform, his foot got caught in the defect and he fell in front of a train that was oncoming. And unfortunately, the train ended up, despite his best efforts, the train ended up severing part of his foot.
Ouch.
Yeah.
You said there's a defect. What kind of defect?
There was a crack in what's called the rub rail. So I don't want to get too technical, but it's the last piece of the platform, essentially, between the concrete portion of the platform where the public would stand and wait and the tracks where the train, you know, would be expected to kind of bump into the platform. So there's a rail there that they call the rub rail. And it was defective in that it was a piece of wood that was basically rotten. And when he stepped on it, it cracked and he went down.
And what were some of the challenges in the case?
Oh, how long is the podcast? first off, the defect wasn't really so apparent. We were able to establish notice of the defect through the transit authority's records. We had some experts go and take a look at the rub rail to show that it was rotten and it must have been defective for some time. I think the biggest challenge that's probably, I know Jessica's probably itching to talk about it. The biggest challenge was that we were facing a defense that was essentially, this person didn't fall. He tried to commit suicide and jumped in front of the train, which unfortunately, we see that defense a lot with the transit authority. I can't tell you how many cases I have where the knee-jerk response is, oh, someone jumped in front of the train. Once you actually investigate, you realize that a lot of these things are kind of just stamped in that fashion and not really investigated. But in this particular instance, we also had an eyewitness, a 15-year-old female on her way to high school. Felicia was in high school. She was on her way to school and she was standing about 5 feet away from him. And she swore that he, ran towards the train on a 90-degree angle and leapt right in front of it and quote unquote timed his jump to essentially kill himself. And that was an extremely difficult obstacle. We tried to figure out why is this story with this client, why is it not making sense? He had no psychological history, no mental health problems before, but you have this witness who seemed extremely credible. She was a lifeguard, she was in the military, and she's standing there with no skin in the game and saying, nope, I 5 feet away and I saw it and this is what happened. And so we were dealing with that for the entire litigation.
So Jessica, how did you get involved?
So Nick called me a few weeks before the first trial date. It ended up getting pushed, I believe, but he had called me and said, I want you to come pick the jury in this case. And so he sent me all the case documents and other than just the 15-year-old who said that he jumped, we also had other witnesses who, like the person cleaning the rails below, had said, don't jump. There were a lot of different people saying that he had committed suicide and jumped. And so we only had our client saying, I didn't do that. We had nobody else that was an independent witness who said it, saw him trip or fall. So when he had called me and told me about the case, my first instinct is, okay, well, this is a trip and fall. So, which I don't usually call things that, but for our purposes, I will.
Right.
And, and so do we have proof that the defect was there? Do we have any photos of that it was there for a certain amount of time? Why is he walking on the rub rail, which is right next to the train, which they say stay off the yellow? So I'm focused on a lot of that to begin with. And it turns out that the reason he's walking on the rub rail is because they're doing construction there. And so what they've left is about, 14 inches, Nick, to walk? About 14 inches to navigate. So when you're walking around and you have to pass somebody, you're walking on the yellow on the rub rail because there's no room. But we couldn't really argue that as an argument. We had to argue he fell and tripped on the rub rail. So that was my right away, I'm thinking this is just a tough trip and fall case to begin with. And then you add on top of it the suicide part. And, I told Nick, I said, Nick, you have to settle this case. I don't think you should pay me to come.
That was our first call. Hey, Jessica, help me pick the jury. I looked at the material. You need to settle this case.
And what'd you tell her, Nick?
There was no offer. I said, I can't settle the case. They're offering nothing. They're saying it's suicide. I got nothing to take.
That's what I really, really love. When you go to trial and they offer you either nothing or an offer that puts no money in your client's pocket and they just make it easy. Because it's like you got nothing to lose. Once you've tried enough cases, you've won some, you've lost some, you're not going to have the ego component as much. And you can just go there and let it rip.
And that's what we did.
Okay, so Jessica, you tell him, settle it. And he says, I can't. So what do y'all do next?
So luckily there was a little time in there because we did end up getting pushed out. And so we had time to look back through things. I don't know if this document came up later. I don't remember the timing of this. But she had filled out, at some point they went back to her when she was 17 and trial was approaching. And they had her fill out a witness statement. Said, the trial's coming up. We need you to fill this out for what you saw. So Nick said, look at this witness statement. And I'm starting to read it. And he said, I did a really fast depo of her about it, you know, about 60 minutes long. Just watch the video of this and tell me what you think of her. So I'm watching the video of her and I said, she looks really incredible. I mean, she comes off very well and speaks well and eloquent and poised. And so, but I'm reading this document and it reads not like a 15 or 17 year old would have written something. I mean, it reads like an affidavit to the point that it says at the end, this is true to the best of my recollection. And says, you know, the platform was clean and dry. There were no defects on the platform. The train conductor was not at fault. The MTA was not at fault. And so I said, there's no way she wrote this on her own. And she claims they did not help her at all. This was written by her. There was no assistance. She wrote it. She turned it into them. And she was straight-faced when she said all of it. There was no wavering from her. So with that piece of evidence, and some of the facts that went with it, you know, that when this happened, and I'll let Nick tell the story, they tried to track down her. They tried to track down our plaintiff and get some statements. And that made it a little bit suspicious, too, in terms of the timing. And so I thought, okay, we have a shot at this. Let's try to tell this story of the MTA doing a cover-up. But we have to be really careful because we don't have direct evidence of anything. We just, you know, if we get ahead of the jurors and we start telling this story and asking in jury selection about a cover-up and they're not there, then we've lost the case. So it was a really, really tricky balancing act of when to say things and how far to go with everything. But that's where I thought we may have something. If we can get them thinking that the MTA covered this up and created witnesses and is tampering with witnesses, now we've got a verdict.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Nick, what did you do? So you've got this seemingly nice girl with no skin in the game saying he tried to kill himself, people yelling, don't jump, and he just jumps in front of the train. Yeah. What do you do? I mean, that's a tough fact.
Immediately what we tried to do after our deposition and we, you know, we did a video recording of the deposition to try to see, you know, who is this person? You know, what we checked her background. Does she have any relation to the MTA? We checked her parents. Do they work for the MTA? You know, why is this, you know, why is she writing a statement like this? And, you know, she's totally, you know, it's like a summary judgment affidavit for the Transit Authority. It was insane. Like down to the, you know, identifying my client as the male, writing like a detective almost. So, we knew there was something to it, but we just couldn't put the pieces together. We didn't have it. Like Jessica said, we didn't have the smoking gun. And all we could kind of do was poke holes and try to insinuate certain things, but she was really keeping my timing back with, you know, going fully in on trial, accusing the MTA of, you know, authoring or tampering with a witness. So all we did was, hey, we're going to try the best case we can. The client's going to come off credible because what happened is what happened. We had a biomechanical, engineer actually that we retained. We also retained an emergency medicine physician. So we wanted to paint the full picture. Number one, the first step in trying this case was, is this a suicide or not? Because if it's a suicide, we're done. If it's not a suicide, then he fell. I mean, it's as simple as that. Let's present all of the evidence that we can to explain to this jury that he wasn't suicidal. He never had any suicidal thoughts. He was cleared when he went to the hospital. Even though the emergency room records was riddled with jumped in front of a train, suicide, all this stuff, he was cleared from the psychiatric team a few days after the incident, and you know, that was step one. You know, if this wasn't a suicide, it must have been an accident. And if that was an accident, now we have two theories. It's either he fell because of the defect, and everything that happened after that is a result of that defect and that fall, or if they, for whatever reason, they didn't agree with the defect, and let's say he just was clumsy and walked off the side of the platform and fell onto the tracks, did the operator have enough time to stop to avoid the actual impact and save him? So what we were able to do through the emergency medicine expert and the biomechanical was to show that based on the pattern of his injuries, it's clear that he tried to get out of the way of this train. If we put all of the evidence together and he fell and where he fell into the middle of the tracks, he ended up on one side, on the opposite side of the train, underneath a little lip of the platform on the other side of the track. and where the train hit him and how it kind of sliced his foot instead of crushing him completely, it tended to show that he tried to get out of the way. So someone who's suicidal doesn't then get out of the way of right. the train. So we started there. And really, well, that
they did say he just changed his mind. I mean, that's what they said. Is he, you know, mid jump, he changed his mind. But he's also not suicidal now. I mean, if you think if you're going to be suicidal once you lose your foot, that might be when you would show those tendencies. And he's never had anything since.
Yeah. So I mean, he also had a dislocated hip, a fractured vertebrae. So I mean, there were other injuries there, but we were able to put it together to show exactly how he was situated when the train passed over his foot, essentially. And
well, I think that's huge. I mean, having the actual forensic evidence, you know, because I think a lot of jurors understand now that witness testimony can be somewhat suspect no matter what.
Yeah.
People don't always remember what they saw in a horrific, when something horrific happens. But I think, absolutely adding the forensic proof. Do they have any biomechanic or forensic person to say otherwise?
They had an engineer to talk about the train operator, but it didn't go well for them. They tried to say that the operator had, you know, based on the testimony, the operator had, you know, no opportunity to stop the train. My client jumped right in front of the train with only a few feet to spare. And it was just a miracle that he wasn't killed. And I remember in their closing, they said he got lucky on you know, the date of the incident. He got lucky and he's lucky to be alive. Don't make him lucky again and give him money. Okay. I was like,
wow. Okay.
There were a lot of anger points in that trial. I will say that definitely helped too. I mean, the reason they came up with that he was suicidal is because he was single with no kids. And most of our jury was single with no kids. They said some really absurd things. Yeah. So
they almost would have been better without trying to come up with a reason.
Yeah.
I mean, they really played into the suicide. And they talked about his, you know, he's a single guy. He was Muslim. He wasn't sexually active. So basically he had nothing to live for. And we basically said, well, maybe they think his life sucks and he has nothing to live for. But for him, his life was everything. I mean, he had no reason to kill himself. He had a great job. He was making really good money. And he was well liked. But I had his boss, his former boss, come in and testify about how great he was. So it really lended to, again, that first prong, which was we have to show that he's not suicidal. This wasn't intentional. This was an accident. And then we can go from there.
Well, and even as he was in the hospital, he called his boss from the hospital and said, "Don't give up my job. I'll be there Monday."
Wow. Yeah. Besides the boss, how else did you show that this is not a suicidal person? I mean,
so a lot of it was the medicals. We used the emergency medicine physician to go through. I mean, he had 2,000 pages of hospital records, so he boiled through it and to take a look and see, and we did just that. I mean, we went through his psychological history, the evaluation that was conducted. So it was really, just kind of trying to get that the expert testimony to, bolster what his claim was.
Well, and I think also, like they said, that he would never tell anybody that he was suicidal because of his Muslim religion, that would have been taboo. And so that's why there's no documentation of him being suicidal. Right. It didn't play well to a really diverse New York jury who, just did not buy that. And I think they played their hand wrong even with that argument, because they did some things with experts on the stand asking doctors of certain ethnicities if it was taboo in their religion, and they had the religion and the ethnicity wrong. So it just was
right.
Wow.
Not and that good was, for them.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, a lot of times our best verdicts, there's a gift from the other side. Because I think once they go all in on the suicide, if the jury doesn't believe it, then they're going to be mad at them. And they're also going to think, well, to falsely accuse someone of killing themselves, you must have done something wrong.
Yeah.
How did you establish your damages?
So we brought in the doctor from the emergency room, the trauma surgeon. He also had multiple treating physicians. He was, because he had the lumbar fracture. So we brought in all of his treating physicians, with the exception of the physical therapist. So I think there was 15 or 16 total witnesses on this one.
So
it's a lot. I mean, between our witnesses and the defense witnesses, may have even been slightly more. But I don't know if it was a combination of just their theory being offensive. They also, their experts were just not, you know, they just didn't hold up. And that was big. Actually, after the case, one of the jurors actually came up to me and said, you know, they threw all these different things, but your case was bulletproof. He literally said your case was bulletproof. Like they there was nowhere that the experts were standing like on cross-examination. I had one of my, and this was, I actually told the story today. One of our experts was the engineer who was going to look at the operator's, you know, conduct and see, you know, did they have an opportunity to stop based on this testimony, based on the, you know, positioning and the speed and everything. And I had this whole thing planned, you know, this whole direct examination. We were going to go through everything and really lay into all of the real technical stuff. And as we're starting, I am watching the jury and they're liking what he's saying. And I'm like, oh, there's no, they're liking what he's saying. We don't even have to get too technical. So it might start confusing everybody. I had him on direct for 15 minutes. I sat down and the defense attorney was like shocked. And gets up. Can I get 3 minutes? What, I don't need a break. And their direct was maybe an hour and a half of this witness. I'm sorry, their cross was the best direct I could have done. I mean, it was, I just went up there, boom, what happened? This is it. 15 minutes. I've never had a witness on direct in 15 minutes. And it just worked that way. The jury was responding to it. So we adapted during the trial and just cut it short and got what we needed. And then they started punching and it only just proved our case.
You know, I'm a big believer in that and in boiling the case down to, you know, the essentials and keeping it short. I think jurors appreciated it. And it does force us to be super clear. But I think the other thing you did that was so brilliant there is you felt the room. You felt the energy in the room. If you see that they're with you, you know, you don't need to, you know, it's a thing I tell my wife all the time. Like, I've already agreed with you. You don't need to keep arguing. Like,
yeah.
You tell
yeah.
me something, I say yes, and you tell me all the reasons why I should say yes. It's like, but I've already said yes.
Right.
I don't need to hear the rest. You're just going to convince me otherwise.
That's a huge practice tip for, you know, we talked about, you know, potential practice tips and things like that. I learned that, you know, early on as well, you know, arguing motions and, you know, you get the decision you want and you just have the natural inclination. You want to just prove that, you know, you're right. And, yeah. and one of the judges looked at Mr. Liakis, stop talking. You won. Yeah. Oh, okay. That's how this works. All right. So I'm done. You get the answer you want. Stop. That's it. Yeah. Keep going. Yeah. Run out of the room.
I think it's a Texas expression, but a federal judge told me 30 years ago, Cowan, when you strike oil, you stop drilling.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you won, stop talking.
Okay. Yep. You can only mess it up.
Yep. So tell me about jury selection. What was y'all's approach to jury selection? I know there's so many different ways to pick a jury.
Well, I'm gonna defer to Jessica on this one. I mean, to be honest, I love picking jurors with Jessica because we framed the selection beforehand. We have an idea, and it frees me up to just speak to the room, right? So and learn and create a bond and look them in the eye and understand what they're saying. And so Jessica's in the back with her notes and you know, trying to look at the different, you know, aspects of the answers and the room. And I'm just having conversation. And then I'll go back and I'll have the luxury of talking to Jessica and saying, all right, here's why I like this person. What do you think? And then she'll have the actual notes on these people instead of me, you know, breaking my concentration to write. I think having, especially on a high exposure case like this, having Jessica was invaluable. So Jessica, this is your expertise. Absolutely. Here. I'll let you take the floor.
Sure. I think first, to lead in, New York's jury selections tend to be very different from other places. So I want listeners to understand that. And I understand it may not be every court in New York, but a lot of them, there's no judge there. So you walk in and you're there with the other counsel and you're making deals from the start, which is very New York, right? Everybody's making deals on how many jurors do we want and how many alternates are there going to be and how do you want to seat them? So none of this is decided for you. You have to determine all of this, and there's some negotiating going on even just with that. And some of the beauty of that in Nick's case, because he's so good at working a room, is he can go up and start forming a bond with the jurors before we've even started jury selection. I mean, he's going to pick them up from the clerk's office, and he has their names in a folder, and he has the lotto ball where you pull out the juror names. And he's leading, you know, here's where the restrooms are and everybody follow me. And this is how this is going to work. Defense attorneys don't even know what's going on. They're not even conscious to the fact that there's something happening, right? They wake up when it's their time to start asking questions or when Nick starts asking questions, but they didn't know that he'd already won them over before we even started. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really interesting. With this group, I don't remember the specific jurors, but I know that there was a time where I didn't like the first, like, there were maybe five or six in the front row, and I told Nick, I don't like four of them. I've got to get through these people to get to some of the ones in the back, who I don't really know that well. I know them somewhat, but there were a couple that I really liked, and I didn't know when they would come because it's all random. But I knew that I didn't like those front four. And so we had to play a little bit of chicken with some strikes and get people to move around and make sure that I could get to that point.
Can one of you explain the struck box method? Because, I mean, it's so different than the way that most jurisdictions do it. So, Nick, maybe you want to explain how it works?
In terms of selection?
Yeah, like the process of, you know, you get so many, you talk to and you do the strikes from those people, and then you get some mm-hmm. more, and then you do the strikes from those people.
So like Jessica mentioned, I mean, selection can be different every time you pick. It really can. I mean, there are certain methods that you try to, you know, agree upon. But generally, I mean, in this instance, what we did was we sat 9 or 12 jurors. We just sat them. We were in a courtroom. A lot of times we're not in a courtroom, you know, we're in a different area. But we were in the Bronx in this case. So we were in a courtroom picking, and we sat 12 jurors. We speak to those 12 jurors. And if they're acceptable, we keep them. And then if not, you remove them. And if there's a peremp, then you know, no problem there. And if there's a cause challenge, then great. But, you know, it's a lot of negotiating, really. I mean, that's really what it is. Like you're starting selection with a negotiation already. So, you know,
let's say you have 12 in there. You talk to those 12 first. You make your strikes on those 12.
Right.
Then let's say five people get stricken. So you've got seven. Now you'd have five more come up, and you question them, and you do the strikes on those five, and you keep going until you have a full panel. Is that right?
Correct. And that's why it's tough, because in some instances you would refill the seats with five new people. Others, you would slide the jurors down, and whoever, you know, let's say you 1 through 5 were stricken, six would become one, and then you'd slide everybody in the back. So you have to set the ground rules before. And then there's, you know, the alternating strikes and everything like that. So it turns out to be fair.
But when you only have so many strikes, you have to like bet like, okay, I've not talked to the whole crowd. I want to strike this person, but I don't know who's going to be next in that chair.
Right.
It's a little different than when you have like the whole crowd you're striking from at once. It's just strategic.
Although we knew a little, I mean, he did talk to the whole crowd to begin with before we pulled jurors up. So we had some feel for them a little bit, just not in depth. But I could hear them talking in bigger picture issues, lawsuits, you know, money. He did a lot of that to the group, so I had some feeling of it, which is a lot nicer than when you have absolutely no idea. But I for those who have an option of how many people you put in the box or you can negotiate with the judge, I really like to have the number in the box that plus your strikes that you're going to end up with. So in this case, I was trying to get us 12 or 18, because by the time we use our strikes, that would be who you have. Whereas the defense attorney wanted less in there. And I said, but then you don't know who's coming. And so it's a risk to everybody that way. Why would you not want to have a feeling for it? But he didn't want that. So we negotiated. We ended up somewhere in the middle. I think we ended up at 9.
Yeah, because 29 years ago when we did it, we also, you know, like I said, that was a long time ago. So, but we only had the people, like, I think it was going to be like a 6 or 8-person jury. We had that many people in the box and had to keep going through.
Right.
So I'm going from very, very distant memory, though. So what were y'all looking for in jury selection?
I mean, we were just looking for open minds. I mean, jury selection is, for me, it's, you know, everyone says it's, you know, deselection, which it is. But, you know, just trying to find if there are any monsters in the room. And that's the hardest part. You know, you don't want to have a sleeper in the room that just no matter what, is not going to like you, not going to like the case, or has a problem with certain things. So we were really just trying to see if people would be open to, number one, because we knew we were going to ask for big money. Open to bigger awards. And then we were really going into, I think laying the foundation for what Jessica mentioned. We didn't go full conspiracy from the beginning, but we were kind of like pulling that thread to see if hopefully at some point during this trial, we get a break and then we can go, you know, we can go with 2 feet. So it was just kind of laying the foundation of, putting a little skepticism in there.
How did you do that?
So, I mean, really, it's just listening to the jurors. I mean, there's really no better that I've had, like no better, way to describe it than just try to develop some sort of relationship, get them comfortable, get their guard down so that they can have a real conversation with you. We're in the Bronx. No one's got, for the most part, no one really has problems with making monetary awards or gets shy about big numbers. We were trying to make it more so about, how important is it for people to take care of their property, their premises, and, why is it important? Is it important to you? What kind of work do you? I remember we had one custodian who I loved, and he took such pride in his work. And I just kept talking to him so the rest of the room could hear, morning I do this, and that's my responsibility. I'm very diligent with how I maintain these buildings because why are you doing? Oh, because people can get hurt and that, So we were trying to kind of build, they kicked him off the panel. They used one of their ramps on him, but.
Best expert witness you had though.
Yeah. He was great for us. Right? Jessica, I'm sure you remember him because that was like your favorite witness, your favorite juror. Sure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, it's really the go back to the I'm a big believer in you know build your tribe, in selection. I'm sure we've all heard that, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do more and more. And with Jessica's help, we've been successful in doing it.
Did you address the suicide allegations at all?
Of course. Of course. We brought it out. We said, listen, you're going to hear some harsh words, and you may hear suicide. You may have to contemplate suicide in this case, and you're. How does everybody feel about that? What would you expect if, you were going to see somebody who was suicidal? What would your expectation be? And what if it didn't fit that expectation? And, would you be open to, XYZ alternatives? And just asking, very different ways of asking, can you keep an open mind under these circumstances?
So how did you structure your opening?
It was just facts. I mean, we didn't get crafty. It wasn't until closing, actually the night before closing, where we really started to get artful, like try to really, get more theater put into it. Because again, in the beginning, this is slightly an uphill battle, I would say, right? We have witnesses that are going to come in, multiple witnesses that are going to come in. We mentioned the young woman. But there was also a station cleaner who was nearby who said he heard people screaming, "Don't jump." The train operator who said that she heard people, yelling. And then this guy, here he comes midair right into her windshield. We knew that it was going to be a case where they were going to call the client's credibility into question. And obviously, as the attorney, now you're kind of getting your credibility looked at a little bit because, you're representing this guy and we don't know if he's telling the truth and you're the one representing him. So it was really just laying the foundation to be the most credible person. Whatever's bad, we're going to say it. Whatever's good, we're going to say it. But we have to maintain above all else our credibility. And then we ended up by the end of the case, it turned into a question of the defendant's credibility. So we were able to flip it 100% on them. And that's when we really went in for the kill during closing.
Jessica, anything on the framing or sequencing and opening you thought was helpful?
I don't remember I know we worked on a lot of it, but I don't remember it. I know that we just had to go really light on any of these other issues. So we really tried it like a defect on a platform case. I mean, that's what it was. It was a defective platform case. And I kept telling Nick, don't say it's a trip and fall. It's a defective platform.
That's true.
So, that's where we had to focus because we couldn't say the rest of this until we felt where things were going and how the witnesses came out and what we were going to do with this. I mean, as he's giving opening, we still had people searching backgrounds on this girl to figure out what the deal was with her. So we were still hoping to find something. And although we found a couple who was the same exact name as her mother and father, who the mother did work for the MTA. And I kept saying, this has to be them. It has to be. They live in the Bronx. All this, everything lines up. But the birth dates weren't right. So we could never link it.
We went through a lot of this. This case is horrible, settle it. And then, we have a plot and it's horrible again. And we have a break and it's not a break. So it was
on every case.
Yep.
So what advice did you give Nick on cross-examining, especially the teenage girl, but the other hostile lay witnesses?
We had to go, I mean, our first inclination was to say maybe she's mistaken on how she saw it. Because a lot of the things she said in terms of how he came out, you know, she said he leapt from the platform. But when she explains what leapt meant, it, you know, his head was down. Well, you don't jump and with your head down, right? You fall with your head down. So our first thought was to make it so that she's just mistaken. You know, we don't want to attack a 15-year-old girl if the jurors like her and we can't prove why she's saying this. I have no idea. I still to this day cannot figure out what they did to make her say it. So I didn't want him to go too harsh on her. And we had this issue where for a long time she was talking to us. We'd call and she would answer the phone. Oh, yeah, anything you need, whatever. And then all of a sudden she went dark. And then she was unavailable for trial. So I think she thought we were the other side when we were and realized who we were. And so then we had the problem that she wasn't going to come into court. There was no way to cross-examine her at all. So we had to go with what he had already recorded. But when he recorded it, he had gone through some of the inconsistencies and the fact that this sounded like an affidavit, but not to the same extent we would in trial.
Right.
So the decision was, do we put in the affidavit or not? And my inclination was, I think the affidavit, it's good for you because it does not sound like a statement. But we didn't know that, right? We hadn't tested it. I didn't know what people thought. And his concern was, the more it says he jumped, I saw him run and jump, it puts it, in writing. It's in front of the jurors in a more concrete form. So we had a lot of back and forth about that. And it did end up coming in. And I do think it probably helped us.
Yeah. I mean, I closed on that. That was my... I think what really was the break was the affidavit came in. We had incident reports from the cleaner, from the latrine operator, and I've tried plenty of cases against the transit authority. I think three out of my last four were against the transit authority. So they have a phrase in their reports that they always write, and so what I did was I put up the first report and I went mentioned some highlighted some things. And one of the aspects that I highlighted and I put it up for the jury was the station was clean, dry, and well lit. Okay. Well, it's not a garbage case. It's not a slip and fall case. It's not a defective lighting case or, so that's in there because that's what they put. Then I go to the station cleaner. It was clean, dry, and well lit. Here they go again. They say it again. I mean, they're trained to do this. And then I had those two side by side on my screen. And then the third one I brought in was the affidavit from the 15-year-old, or she was 17 at the time, and jammed somewhere in that thing, it said it was clean, dry, and well lit.
Same words.
I was like, what? This is straight out of the Transit Authority's textbook of what they teach people to put in their reports. And I think that was a big break because it's like, what are the chances that this girl just randomly put that in there and it just matches everything else the irrelevant facts that they put in.
And I will say like the other facts that we didn't mention about it that made it seem really suspicious is as soon as this happened, the MTA police went straight up to the girl who was having a panic attack at the time and tried to get her statement as she's having a panic attack. It was morning at rush hour time. They didn't get statements from anybody else. Only hers. I'm sure they got statements from other people, but that's what they had. And then they went straight to the hospital to try to interview our client. As he's, getting treatment for his leg being chopped off, he refused to talk to them. Well, they made it seem like he refused to talk to the police. And they said, well, why did you refuse to talk to the police? He said, because it wasn't the police. It was the transit police. And I didn't want to talk to them. And so that when he wouldn't talk, they went back to her. So their fingerprints were all over it from the start, just trying to manufacture it.
Absolutely. So how did you bring it all home in closing?
The night before, Jessica gave me, I got to give her full credit on it. I got to share credit with Jessica and whatever, however many trial lawyers have done this, this closing. But, we were talking about how do I close here? How do I get them to care? How do I get them to give, money on this? Because they may be reserved if they're not sure. And, maybe he could have tried to kill himself, maybe not, but let's give something because we're not sure. And let's, kind of split it. How do we get them to fully commit? So once we laid all that stuff out with the witness and how, that insinuation, that it's that something wasn't so independent about this witness, we were talking about, all right, how do I close and what do I ask for? And, you know, the night before every closing, I'm sure you've done it 1,000 times, right? So he goes, why don't you go man in the black suit? I said, what the hell's the man in the black suit? She's like, well, you never heard this? No, I've never heard this. So she gives me, I'm sure you've heard it, but if you haven't, the man in the black suit, she told to me a couple of times over the phone. And
to Nick Raleigh on that one.
Yeah. And I hung up. I thought about it. I called her back. I said, can you say it again? Give it to me again. Like, do the whole thing. So she gave it to me again, hung up. I thought about it. I went for a drive. I went for a walk, came back. It was probably midnight by the time I'm calling her again. Give it to me one more time. Okay, great. Show up the next day. And there was the man in the black suit. And we delivered it. Give it to me.
I want to hear it.
So the man in the black suit, essentially, it talks about how do you know that $50 million, $30 million, $20 million is enough? So I want you to imagine, and I might, Jessica, I may need some touch-ups on this. So let me know if I haven't used it since then. But, you know, I want you to imagine the night before this incident, Maruf Hussein, that's my client, was in his apartment in the Bronx, and he gets a knock on his door. So I knock on the thing, you know, try to make it real for the jury. He gets a knock on his door. He gets up on his own 2 feet. You know, she's in perfect health, the young 24-year-old, getting ready for work the next day. And he opens the door and he sees a man standing there in a black suit. And the man standing there, he's got a black tie. He's got black shoes, a black briefcase. He came in a black SUV. He's got black glasses on. And he says, are you Maruf Hussein? And yes, I am. He goes, I have $30 million for you in this briefcase. It's yours. And he goes, well, I didn't, what do you mean? I didn't do anything. I don't know what this is. Maybe you have the wrong house. No, you're Maruf Hussein. This is for you. Sir, I didn't earn this money. Well, who are you? Don't worry. You will. And ultimately it goes through the whole sequence of events where the guy says, tomorrow morning, you're going to wake up. You're going to go to the train. You're going to wash your face. You're going to get up. You're going to go to the train station that you always go to. And you're going to go to get on the train and get to work on time. But before you get there, you're going to fall onto the tracks. And that train is going to start coming and it's going to barrel down on top of you. And you're going to do everything you can to get out of the way. But unfortunately, the train is going to hit you. And when it hits you, it's going to take your foot off. You're going to have a broken back. You're going to have a dislocated hip. You're going to have all these injuries. You're going to spend some months some time in the hospital. You're going to have to go to rehabilitation. You'll never be able to work again. You won't be able to do X, Y, Z. We laid it all out. But that's the deal that I've made for you. And here's your money. Sir, I don't want this. Get out of my house. Shuts the door on him. But as he's shutting the door, he puts his foot out. And the man says, Mr. Hussein, you don't understand. You don't get to choose. The deal's already been made. And he leaves the briefcase. And so I told the jury, that's how we know that the $30 million in that briefcase isn't enough, because he would never take that deal. But the transit authority gave him no opportunity to speak for himself. And they made the deal for him. And now he has to live with it. So that's how we kind of softened it up to get to that figure. You know, it was... I got to give credit where it's due. You know, I've never used it before. I don't know if I'll use it again, but you know, it certainly connected. And the jury, you know, they took a lot of time thinking about it. I got nervous. I did. I got to admit, it was like a 2-day deliberation. But they came back unanimous. They came back 100% on the transit authority. There was no negligence on the plaintiff. And they gave us $23 million. Oh, just about 23. Wow. Yeah,
that's an incredible, incredible result.
Yeah, I'm
very proud of you. And
thank you.
You guys did incredible work on that case. So, kind of to wrap it up, if you have one piece of advice each of you for lawyers that are getting ready to try a tough case, what would you tell them?
I mean, sometimes you have no choice. You're always going to have a tough case. Every case has its difficulties. There is no such thing as a perfect case, and if there was, it probably wouldn't go to trial. So, you know, every case is different. You know, try to, before you start picking, try to understand how you want to close, what the law that's going to be read. You know, a lot of people don't, I start every trial with, what are my jury instructions? You know, where do I need to end? So that I can pepper that throughout my trial and I can frame my questions appropriately. So, you know, it's a tough trial. They're going to come. That's part of it. You win, you lose. Hopefully you win more than you lose. But, you know, just you have to be ready to jump in. And if you prepare, you've done all you can. You can't change the facts on your case. All you can do and all your job is as a lawyer is to present them in the most effective and the most efficient way possible and hope for the best result. That's all you can do. So preparation is key. Try to always sharpen your skills. We actually built a full courtroom in our office, and we leave it open to any plaintiff's attorney that wants to come. I actually had someone that was scheduled to come today, but he got tied up to put on his case, and our team was going to cross-examine his witness. And we have a former judge that actually takes the bench, and we do the whole thing. And it's open to any plaintiff lawyer that wants it. I've had people come in and use it, and great. This case, the Hussein case, was actually the first one since our courtroom was built that we actually put through the courtroom and the whole thing and did the whole mock trial. So preparation is all you can control. And I would say, if you know, hard case, easy case, they're all going to have their difficulties. But if you can control your preparation, you've done your job.
Jessica?
I think I would say don't try too hard to over-try the case. I think it's a instinct in a tough case that you get kind of defensive, and then you push too hard on things that you think are going to save you, or push on the little things that you don't know if the jury is going to buy it or not. And then you risk overshooting it or losing your credibility. So I think you have to tread lightly in tough cases. And once you feel like things are going your way, you can ramp it up a little bit. But you have to feel the room, and you have to start slow, and you have to build on that and sort of figure it out as you go. But don't go in there pointing a bunch of fingers where jurors may not want to point fingers, or you know, trying theories that you don't know if they're going to buy it or not. So that's the hard part, I think, with tough cases is holding back enough, but knowing when to then step forward.
Absolutely. So last thing, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, we'll have your contact information in the show notes. But for those listening, how do they find you, Nick?
I can call my office. They can send me an email. I'm on LinkedIn. Our website has our information. We work with a lot of different attorneys. We have a lot of referral partners. We're trial counsel to, I don't know how many dozen firms in New York and New Jersey. We welcome that. And like I had mentioned before, if any plaintiffs out there, need a courtroom, want to run a case by, our team here, and we can assist in any way, we're happy to do it. And, just like you, Michael, we appreciate what you do for the profession, and we try to give back as well.
Thank you. Jessica, how do people find you?
You can go to my website or you can email me. The website is trialdynamics.net. And my email is jessica@trialdynamics.net.
Well, thank you all so much, Nick. You've really inspired me. I can't wait to go try my next case. And I have a partner, Mallory, that did a different version of the Man in Black closing, but I like hearing yours. Might try that again. And listeners, thank you so much for listening, and join us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Thank you for joining us on Trial Lawyer Nation. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you'd like to receive updates, insider information, and more from Trial Lawyer Nation, sign up for our mailing list at triallawyernation.com. You can also visit our episodes page on the website for show notes and direct links to any resources in this or any past episode. To help more attorneys find our podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast on any of our social media outlets. If you'd like access to exclusive plaintiff lawyer only content and live monthly discussions with me, send a request to join the Trial Lawyer Nation Insider Circle Facebook group. Thanks again for tuning in. I look forward to having you with us next time on Trial Lawyer Nation.
Each year, the law firm of Cowan Rodriguez Peacock pays millions of dollars in co-counsel fees to attorneys nationwide on trucking and commercial vehicle cases. If you have an injury case involving death or catastrophic injuries and would like to partner with our firm, please contact us by calling 210-941-1301 to discuss the case in detail and see where we can add value in a partnership. This podcast has been hosted by Michael Cowan and is not intended to, nor does it create, the attorney-client privilege between our host, guest, and any listener for any reason. Content from the podcast is not to be interpreted as legal advice. All thoughts and opinions expressed herein are only those from which they came.